Hello and welcome to Speaking with Carl Thornton Jr. How has the week been going for you? You know, I know some of you have been out of school for a little while. Some of you have been out and you're getting ready to start right back in a day or two, a week or two. Did you get some rest? That's important. You don't want to burn yourselves out. I know you enjoy school. I do too, but we do need to rest. So get your rest when you can. And so what's next? What's next on your agenda? What comes up next? What do you do that's going to excite you for the summer? Parents, remember, be checking out some of these camps, summer camps, because you definitely want to be able to get your children involved in some of that for their betterment, their improvement, their enjoyment, their growth, their development, but also the excitement of knowing that you're doing one more thing to contribute to who they are becoming. And of course, depending on what you have going in your life, it may give you a bit to a chance to just kind of unwind for a bit, just chill a bit while you focus on other activities. Now, before we go any further, I want to run a few things by you, things that I think you're going to be able to use in the coming days, weeks, and months. And the first one has to do with empowering ourselves to be happy.
These healthy habits can help you feel happier today. First, play a mind trick on yourself. Smile and laugh more, even if you've got to fake it. It may help release feel-good brain chemicals. You may not need to force smiles when you play with a pet. Whether it's your own furry friend or a pal's, you'll get unconditional love, and it may lower your stress, too. Another surefire stress buster? Exercise. It doesn't have to be a typical fitness routine or a tough workout. Whether you like to dance, jump rope, play racquetball, or go for a swim, physical activity gets those feel-good brain chemicals flowing. Next, if you're in a relationship, having sex once a week might be enough to lift your mood. The intimacy you and your partner feel may matter more than orgasms. Last but not least, try to do a few minutes of meditation each day. It can help you feel calmer, more centered, and less upset by negative feelings. Here's to your happiness and health.
Thank you, WebMD. We appreciate that. I want to share something else with you, too. And this one has to do with rejuvenation.
What rejuvenates me is being able to transform a client. When a client tells me, Obi, you helped me lose 30 to 40 pounds in 10 to 12 weeks, I just get so much enjoyment out of that. It's unbelievable, you know, and it reinforces the enjoyment I have in my profession and the ability that I have to really inspire and motivate and change people's lives. So that is the greatest rejuvenation for me, is transforming people, both mentally and physically.
What do you think about that? And y'all know that, you know, we've been talking about how helping other people can be so helpful to the helper. So, yes, I think that that is something to keep in mind. I can understand how helping people lose that weight and seeing the smiles on their faces rejuvenates them. I mean, who doesn't feel good when somebody tells you, hey, you really helped me? All right, let me share one more with you. I want to get ready for this. We got the 4th of July coming up and some other holidays. I want you to be thinking about this too. Even when winter starts rolling around and some of you getting ready to travel during Thanksgiving, Christmas, etc., some ways to deal with holiday travel stress.
Grunting over heavy bags, waiting through long lines, disrobing for airport security. Travel can be stressful anytime in today's post-9/11 world, but factor in the holidays.
People have to pack their patience. Just pack your patience with everything else. You'll get here, be considerate of others, and everything will go smooth.
Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport is one of the busiest airports in the world.
If you're traveling together, please separate your documents.
If you can find your way here without losing your mind, chances are you can travel anywhere, anytime. Tip number one, plan ahead. Use airport websites to track your flight. Tip 2, arrive early and dress for convenience and comfort, if you can.
When you're wearing this uniform and you have to take everything out of your pockets, take your top off, take your boots off, it's a little more than just taking off a pair of loafers.
Tip 3, know the rules on liquids. The Transportation Security Administration has implemented a 3-1-1 plan to help make the restrictions more clear.
We currently allow 3-ounce containers of liquid, gel, and aerosol in a 1-quart zip-top bag. Each passenger is allowed one bag and must be placed separately on the X-ray belt.
One boarding pass, one photo ID.
To move through security checkpoints, take tip 4 from a seasoned traveler.
No, I don't, not anymore.
Not anymore carry-on bags, that is.
Now I check everything.
The 3-1-1 solution works very well for someone traveling overnight or on a short weekend trip. We still, however, highly encourage passengers to put items in their checked baggage.
And don't let those long security lines stress you. They move faster than you think.
The more time you spend preparing for screening, the less time you actually spend in screening. Take all the metal off. Take your watches off. Take the keys out of your pocket. Take the money clip out if you happen to have one and put it in your carry-on baggage. Any shoe with a thick sole or thick heel will be subjected to additional screening. One option would be to wear something with a very thin sole or just be prepared to take your shoes off.
Tip 5, get plenty of rest before you travel and limit alcohol and caffeine while you travel. Of course, some folks have the right attitude from the beginning.
Do you feel yourself stressed when you try to travel on the airplanes?
Never. I love the airport. I actually enjoy other people stressing out because it makes me feel better about myself.
Wishing you a stress-free holiday, I'm Sandy Lamott.
All right, so y'all who are going to be flying on the 4th or around the 4th, other times during the day, remember now, if you want to chill, you can chill. All you got to do is look at the other people around you who are stressed out and feel good about their stress. But be sure to take care of all those other steps they mentioned too. All right, so here we go. We're going to be talking about DNA tests. How many of you have been really looking hard into what's happening with regards to your ancestry? You really want to know who you came from and maybe to an extent where you came from, what part of the world. You've been really wanting to look into this. Well, I'm going to share with you, courtesy of Popular Science, some information about DNA tests. And I guess our goal will be to determine whether or not we really do want to put a lot of confidence in the DNA testing or whether we want to proceed with caution. So here we go. Let's start with this whole issue of what they were calling the Golden State Killer. He was recently apprehended, and some people are saying that it caught a lot of people off guard. Prior to the big reveal that detectives were able to trace the alleged serial rapist and killer through his DNA, many people hadn't seriously considered the ramifications of handing over their own genetic material to private companies. And now that the, again, suspected, keep this in mind when we say this, the Golden State Killer, remember, as of, early May, when I say early May, the first week of May, he was suspected but not convicted. Golden State Killer's cousin's data is what was supposedly able to help crack the long, unresolved case. Though people have had to start asking themselves just how much information that they and others have willingly given to companies in the form of DNA samples. You know, a lot of people talk about the information given over to Instagram and Facebook. What about through DNA samples? How much should they have given? Well, history is peppered with examples of DNA tracing gone wrong. How many of you can think of some cases that maybe you were not directly involved with, but you heard about it, you read about it? Maybe in a local paper, a daily paper, a weekly paper, you heard about it on the news. Someone was convicted, and the evidence was overwhelming because DNA evidence was used to prove that the person accused was indeed the person guilty, the one who committed the crime. And then something strange began to happen. Someone began to notice that with the so-called DNA evidence, the DNA evidence wasn't actually evidence. Take the phantom female serial killer, whose genetic material turned up at dozens of crime scenes all across Europe. The matches were so consistent. Now get this now. This lady's genetic material was turning up at dozens of crime scenes all across Europe. The matches were so consistent that police were sure it had to be a prolific murderess. As it turns out, the DNA was so perfectly matched because it belonged to a woman who worked at the cotton swab factory where police got their supplies. The swabs were not certified for DNA collection. I'll tell you what, we humans can really make some mistakes. One Houston man spent 4 years in prison now, after DNA evidence seemed to tie him to a rape. It was only after his mother saw a report on errors in crime lab analysis that an attorney reassessed the data and realized that the technician had made fundamental errors in analyzing the samples. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no proof that a person has committed the crime just because someone says DNA evidence proves it. DNA evidence seemed to tie this man to the rape. An attorney later found out that the technician handling the DNA samples had made fundamental errors in analyzing the samples that led an innocent man to prison, where he spent 4 years times 365 days for a crime he had not committed. Think about all of the atrocities that occur in prisons. The rapes, the fights, all of the loss of control, the loss of privacy. Every day for 1,460 days for a crime he had not committed. I'm curious. Does anything happen to the technicians who make the errors? Does anything happen to the technicians or to the attorneys, to the folks who deliberately falsify quote-unquote evidence? Now, here's the thing. When it comes to the one who's being called the Golden Gate Killer, they're not saying that he's necessarily innocent at this point, you know, as of early May. He'll get a trial, and it will be up to the jury to evaluate whatever evidence is presented. It's quite possible that online genome sharing has just helped bring a vicious rapist and killer to justice. Here's the good news. A reminder that DNA analysis is unwieldy, it's increasingly popular, it is cheap, and it is available. A lot of people are really getting into the family tree search. How about you? Well, for many, the news is most surprising because it suggests a consumer DNA test is capable. It's not a sure thing, but it is capable of revealing the truth about your lineage. It's possible, even likely, to get varying results on ethnicity and heritage across different DNA testing kits. So how is this different? First, let's take a look at how DNA testing works. Part of the confusion stems from not understanding what geneticists are really looking at when they analyze your DNA. Now, we're going to mention a couple of companies that do the DNA sampling and testing, etc. This is not for the purpose, though, of promoting any of those companies that do the ancestry searches. Not at all. In fact, as we move on further into the discussion, you hear that more than one company is going to be named. And you'll see that this really is not a promo, at least not from my perception of it. So most of the methods of sampling, analyzing DNA rely on something that's called SNPs. The difference, though, between finding your ancestry and determining your direct relatives lies in what you do with those SNPs. Not every company tracks both immediate relatives and distant ethnic lineages, but places like Ancestry do. They track your potential distant cousins and serve up a summary of where your ancient ancestors might have come from. So, according to Julie Granka, who's a population geneticist at Ancestry, when people send them their samples, the first step is to extract the DNA from the cheek cells so that they can genotype it. DNA contains about 3 billion letters, but they're looking at 700,000 specific positions, which are ones that they know vary between humans. Those specific positions are called SNPs, which stands for single nucleotide polymorphisms. Single nucleotide polymorphisms. That's what SNPs stands for. And they're actually specific positions. When your DNA gets copied, as your body makes new cells, the machinery often makes some mistakes. Most of the major errors get caught. If the code for a critical protein is messed up, that cell often just doesn't survive. Plus, you have some spell-checking proteins that fix mistakes. But it's easy to end up with errors in a single position. So your DNA is made up of building blocks called nucleotides, which scientists refer to as A's, T's as in Tom, C's and G's for the amino acids, adenosine, trioscene, tyrosine, cytosine, and guanine. These pair up with each other. And wherever there's an A on one DNA strand, the matching strand across the latter should have a T. And likewise for C's and G's. Every once in a while, though, the protein copying the strand accidentally inserts the wrong nucleotide in an area of DNA where it doesn't really matter. Maybe it doesn't code for anything at all. Most of your DNA doesn't, is what they say. Or maybe it's a small enough error that it doesn't change the functionality of the cell. That's what an SNP is, a single change at a single position. An SNP, remember that's what that stands for, single nucleotide polymorphisms. And this basically occurs when you have a single change at a single position. Some SNPs cause disease, but for genetic testing purposes, they only look at benign bits. Because these SNPs don't have an impact on the cell's functionality, they don't get fixed. They get passed down through generations. So if one person in England 1,000 years ago got an SNP where an A was swapped for a C at position 3455, many of that person's descendants will have exactly the same SNP. More importantly, because you have billions of possible positions where one might occur, SNPs are unique. If you have an A to C SNP at position 3455, there's a very high chance your ancestors are from England. If you don't, that doesn't mean that you're not originally from England. It just means you don't have that particular marker. Since you're likely to share a lot of SNPs with your close relatives, companies like Ancestry can use the same SNP data to figure out who might be your cousin, as long as that person is in their database. So to some degree, much of genetic testing is just based on what percentage of your DNA, as estimated by SNPs, you share with any other person. But it's a little more complicated than that. Companies like 23andMe and Ancestry have databases full of SNPs that they've traced back to certain parts of the world. when they run your sample, they're comparing your set of S&Ps to their database, then using the matches to determine which areas your ancestors are probably from. Notice I emphasized probably from. But this process is not perfect. Granka explains that your genealogical information is based on a statistical model. It can tell you where you're probably from, but that's it. Ancestry, just like every other company in the field, has built up a database of reference populations. Your results are a direct reflection of which reference populations the company uses, though, and that's why you'll get differing answers. This means that all of your ancestry data is mostly an estimate. That's why companies attach a confidence interval to your results. They may say you're 48% Eastern European, but that they're anywhere from 30 to 80% sure of that result. Anywhere from 30% to 80% sure of that result. Most people focus on the 48% and forget that the results are not for certain. But this can be stated enough. This can't be stated enough. All ancestry results are based on a model, and that model can be wrong. Companies are using cutting-edge scientific methodologies to determine which reference populations came from which areas of the world, but it's always going to be based on assumptions and estimates. Genealogical testing, on the other hand, is more straightforward. They're looking for strands of yours that match to other people in the database, according to Granka. Strands that are identical come from a common ancestor. So, if person A and person B have around 12.5% of their DNA in common, it's absolutely identical. They could say that A and B share a grandparent. Let's get some more on this in just a minute. Wow. Very, very interesting.